So, Tom, we're so pleased to have you here with us this evening, because we would really like to understand, how did we get into this situation, and what are your ideas and thoughts about how do we go forward? Please give him a real round of applause. Tom Ginsberg, our keynote speaker.
Well, thank you so much, Jack, for that wonderful introduction. It is true that I did not know about Chicago Area Peace Action when he first called me, but I will be knowing about it because I plan to join as soon as I get back. It's wonderful work you are all doing, and it's also wonderful to be part of a celebration of all the work that you are doing. Political scientists who study democracy around the world think that the number of democracies peaked in around the year 2006. At that time, and every year since, there have been fewer democracies. And we are now at the point, just last year, where there are more countries and more people living in countries that are not democratic than live in democracies. So this has been an accelerating trend. And it's affecting old democracies, countries like Venezuela, which I think is no longer a democracy, but was, you know, for several decades until the last couple of decades. It's affecting countries like Turkey, which was a middling democracy, I suppose, at best, and also affecting countries where the triumphalism of the 1990s expected that democracy would be consolidated. Places like Hungary and Poland, where scholars thought that democracy was now the only game in town. It turns out it wasn't. Even more worryingly for us, we're seeing the rise of anti-system parties, populist parties that explicitly reject the power and importance of institutions in advanced industrial economies, including, of course, the United States. And this should, of course, worry every citizen. Now, for many people, we have a notion of American exceptionalism, that we stand apart from history, that our history is different from those of other countries, that the forces and trends that we observe everywhere do not affect us. And one of the key arguments we make in this book is that's not the case at all. In fact, the forces we are seeing at play in the United States are exactly the forces that we observe elsewhere around the world. The tactics that are being used to erode democracy are being used here at home. And again, that means potentially that the solutions might be something where we can learn from other places which have experienced near misses or have experienced degradation of the democracy. One way to think about the project is, suppose we had in the United States, you know, a charismatic populist leader that, you know, wanted to degrade democracy, purely hypothetically, or suppose we had something else we observe, a party, a political party that wins so much that it decides it doesn't need to defend democracy anymore. The degradation of democracy by a political party. If we were to have these things, would our Constitution save us? And again, your answer from junior high school is, of course, we have the best Constitution since sliced bread. It's been the key to our wealth and democracy and success for over 200 years. And what we show is that that is not the case. In fact, there are some areas in which the Constitution would actually facilitate and is facilitating the erosion of democracy here at home. So let me try to make the case for this. And the first point I want to make is that the threat to the United States is not really what we might have thought the threat to democracy was. For many years, particularly during the Cold War, the ways that democracies ended were sudden, fast. The military coup, the communist revolution, something like that. And if that's your fear, well, there's a certain set of policies and institutions you would want to empower to protect you against that risk. It turns out, though, that particularly in the last couple of decades, what we are seeing is death of democracy or degradation of democracy in a much slower way, much more incremental way, and one that we argue is actually more dangerous because it's so hard to see. When you have a series of incremental steps, each one on its own may not seem to be critical, but if they involve a number of different dimensions, a number of different institutions, you can wake up one day and have your democracy severely degraded or even ended. without ever having had a single point, a single bright line, a single moment when you could say that was the day democracy died. That's the problem. So when you have institutional degradation and institutional corrosion, one step at a time, it's really hard to identify that. And identifying moments is critical for the defense of democracy. One way to think about this is the idea of mobilization, mass mobilization. There might be some steps that our government would take that would get so many Americans out into the street that it would be impossible for the government to take those steps. This is what we observe when we see mass revolutions, of course, where, you know, there's some moment that occurs and soon there's a social movement, everyone's out in the street, and that does constrain the government, and the fear of those moments constrains government. What would those moments be? I have thought for the last couple of years that the firing of Robert Mueller might be such a moment. Now I'm not so sure. I don't know. If you don't have a single moment when all citizens can coordinate to get out in the street, then you may not have sufficient constraint on government to avoid degrading democracy. So what we do is we identify five different channels, five different sets of tools, and all of these involve, I'm sorry to say, the law. Because that's another feature of our time. Authoritarian regimes nowadays look a lot like democracies. They have elections, they have courts, they have a nominally free media. But in fact, in the substance, those institutions operate very differently. And all those institutions, which we think of as protecting democracy and helping to make it function, are in fact weaponized and used sometimes to degrade democracy. And the law is particularly important here. 20 years ago, we celebrated what we called the judicialization of many areas of public policy. I think many scholars, many law scholars thought, you know, it's okay, the courts, they're the least dangerous branch, right? No purse, no sword, no problem. In fact, though, what we are now observing is that courts and law are being mobilized and weaponized to degrade various important features of democracy. So let me give you five examples, and for each, I'll talk a little bit about some of the developments around the world, and then I'll talk about, sort of give the United States a rating and how we do in this regard. So let me begin with the Constitution itself. Constitutional amendment is becoming more frequent, particularly among regimes that are governed by populists. And my theory about this is that if you're a charismatic populist, if you're a leader like Viktor Orban in Hungary or Erdogan in Turkey, you have to make the claim that you speak for the people. And the people are always unified, right? They are a single, non-pluralist, you know, force. And anyone who opposes the people is an enemy of the people. The people, the people's voice is only expressed exclusively through this leader who directly channels their moods and feelings. And that's a really dangerous position. Such a leader will want to degrade any institution that's intermediate. The media, courts, civil society, all those things are a threat to a charismatic populist. But one of the interesting things that we're also seeing is that those kinds of leaders love constitutions. Why? Well, in their grand theory of the Constitution, you know, the Constitution is the sort of ground zero moment for a legal system. It's when we, the people, get together and we launch a series of government institutions, which will then endure and we'll have ordinary politics within that. But during the moment of the constitutional adoption or constitutional amendment, we're going back to that constituent power, that core power of the people. And if you're a charismatic populist, you love being able to say that. You love being able to invoke the power of the people. And so we see constitutional amendment to entrench the power of the charismatic leader or the party. We see constitutional amendment being manipulated. Viktor Orban's a good example. He's had 7 amendments in 7 years, something like that, in Hungary, because it allows him to speak for the people. Constitutional amendment also allows you to attack the second, to sort of pursue the second means of democratic degradation. And that is to undermine the checks and balances that make up any functioning democratic system. And the techniques here are to bypass the Congress or the Assembly, if it happens to be controlled by your opponents, and to pack the courts. And I want to just say a word about each of those. You know, a good example of bypassing the elected legislature just came last year in Venezuela. Nicolas Maduro, when he happened to lose miraculously the elections to the National Assembly, said, that's fine. We're going to act, you know, the National Assembly can show up and they can pretend to govern, but we're actually going to go back to the power of the people. And so he created a handpicked constituent assembly, invoking the power of the people which he spoke for, and that now directly governs Venezuela. It's the end of Venezuelan democracy. Meanwhile, Chavez and Maduro had both degraded the courts by packing them with supporters and firing the previous set of justices. And this is a move that we see very frequently. Right now, there's a huge battle in the European Union over Poland's statute to reduce the age of their judges to 62. Sort of looks neutral, right? You could have a good governance sort of rationale. Oh, yeah, we need some new blood in the judiciary. But they reduced the age of retirement from 70 to 62, and that meant, of course, that all the senior judges who were challenging Kaczynski and his party were out of office. So packing the courts and bypassing the judiciary. Let me just say a word about these two. How does the United States do in these two regards? And then I'll continue down my list of five. Constitutional amendment is actually something the United States is, we're kind of in some ways blessed with the fact that it's impossible to really manipulate constitutional amendments. It's really hard to pass amendments in our country. So you might think we would be insulated from this channel. But of course, one of the sort of corollaries of that difficulty of amending the Constitution is that you have a tremendous amount of power in the federal courts to interpret them. And so we've seen, I think, a perversion of our democracy in the sense that we're now fighting elections over Supreme Court seats. It doesn't make any sense. We should be fighting elections over policy. Instead, we're fighting over the power to appoint Supreme Court justices. It's too powerful a court. And that's precisely because it allows parties to pack it with supporters. They're there for too long, and the stakes are just too high. It's corrupted our democracy, oddly. So our amendment looks like we do okay, but on the checks and balances, I'm not so sure. Madison and his colleagues, when they were drafting the Constitution, thought that the institutions would act as institutions to check each other. They thought that Congress would act as Congress to constrain the president. But remember, they were writing that document and they developed that theory of accountability before there were political parties, before there were what Madison would have called factions that would take over and unify government. And what we observe in the history of American government is that when you have unified government, you don't see very much accountability. Congress rarely acts as Congress. Certainly now, in terms of their accountability function, they've not been playing that role because of the party incentives. So in a way, it was kind of a design flaw that's baked in. And if you were to look at constitutions elsewhere in the world that are written nowadays, they recognize that, you know, three branches of government isn't really enough. And what we often observe is kind of a set of institutions that are put into the Constitution in order to ensure accountability. So not relying on just institutions checking each other, but a special branch of government just for accountability. Well, let me go on. So I'd say that the United States does pretty well on the amendment side, not so well on the checks and balances because of the partisan nature of things. A third tactic that is used by democratic eroders, if I can use the term, is to undermine the rule of law, and particularly the bureaucratic rule of law. And this is something which, you know, I think is underappreciated, but how important bureaucracy is to democracy. How important meritocratic civil service is to ensure that democratic elections are effective and are continually run. Obviously, you need a bureaucracy that follows the rule of law in order to count electoral votes cleanly and not in a partisan way. But more broadly, I think it's critical that you have a bureaucracy whose job is basically to implement the policy that is produced at the top. If you were to have a system like we had in the 19th century, a spoils system for federal hiring, you know, if the incoming president could hire 2 million federal workers, you know, that's a pretty high-stakes election. And what it probably means is that whoever's in office is not going to give up power. There's something about a meritocratic civil service implementing the policies which actually reduces the stakes of control at the top and makes democracy possible. So I think bureaucracy turns out to be really important for democracy, and I can say more about that down the road. In the United States, we don't do that well. We have, of course, the Civil Service Act, But we also saw some attempts to attack the civil service. The incoming Republican Congress in 2017 revived something called the Holman Rule in the budget process. Didn't get a lot of press. The Holman Rule allows in the budget process in Congress for the legislators to pick out a single civil servant by name, not fire them, but reduce their salary to a dollar. It's legal, and they haven't used it, but this is the kind of tactic which you don't have to use in order to have some effect, to intimidate the civil service and such. And so we don't really have very good protection relative to other countries where you would have a civil service commission, you'd have sort of various devices to protect the civil service from being fired. The next realm in which we see degradation is, of course, the running of elections themselves. And this is something where the United States is maybe the poster child itself for how not to run elections. Indeed, the Economist Intelligence Unit downgraded us last year from being a full democracy to what they call a flawed democracy, largely on the basis of the way we run elections. And this isn't just me or academics saying this. This is something that Americans in survey after survey recognize. So let me, and I attribute actually to the Constitution itself. This is one of those areas where the Constitution is the problem. Madison and his colleagues, again, were writing in an era before political parties. So it may not have seemed odd to them to give the management of elections, the drawing of district lines, to the state legislatures. But of course, that's the proverbial fox guarding the hen house, right? And that's how it's turned out to be. We have partisan gerrymanders on both sides. I just saw that the Maryland one, the Democratic one, was actually set aside by a court the other day. That's a positive development. But the Supreme Court has stayed away from this issue. And some of the gerrymanders are really quite severe. In Maryland, the congressional district was 7 Democrats, 1 Republican, the congressional representation. In Wisconsin, I think it's, it was a 50-50 Trump-Clinton state, but the state legislature is 2/3 Republican. And that has profound effects, right, all throughout the system. So partisan gerrymandering is one obvious consequence. Another one, which I think we're learning a lot about, is partisan secretaries of state. Again, you know, when I grew up, the Secretary of State was not a very important office. Something like, voting for the coroner. Yeah, it might be Democrat or Republican, but it didn't really mean anything in that fundamental sense. But in this electoral cycle, we've now seen, of course, 2 secretaries of state running for office in elections that they are themselves going to administer. All of this seems to me to be quite perverse. Some say that we're in a system where instead of the voters choosing their representatives, the representatives choose their voters. And there's a pretty easy solution that many countries have adopted, and several of the states, which is a nonpartisan districting commission. I think you could also make the Secretary of State a nonpartisan technocratic office. That's a reform which should be achievable. We know that those states, those American states, which do have nonpartisan districting commissions, which are usually adopted by initiative and such, those states have much more responsive elections, much more a representation that reflects the distribution of voters more accurately. So this is within our grasp. But the Constitution, to some degree, is a barrier. And it'd be very hard to completely get around it if states refuse to do it. So that's one where I don't think we score very well. Finally, a great strategy of Democratic eroders concerns the public sphere. Last year was the worst year on record for journalists. More journalists killed, more journalists kidnapped and such, all around the world. It was equally bad for civil society. Throughout many countries, we're seeing civil society subject to new registration requirements, new tax audits, new sort of intimidation tactics, which all look legal and they all seem pretty minor. But the purpose is to shape what civil society says and what civil society does. We also are seeing in many countries attacks on universities, obviously very close to home for me. But the idea, you know, that universities are neutral producers of knowledge in the service of learning and the service of trying to establish facts is under severe attack in many places. In Turkey, when Erdogan had his post-coup reaction, he fired every dean of every university in the entire country. They were allowed to apply for their jobs back. upon an expression of loyalty to him. But that's a fundamental distortion in the way knowledge is produced in Turkey, and I know many, many people who are very, very intimidated there. In Hungary, the government has made a sustained attack on the Central European University, which was set up by George Soros in the end of the Cold War, the aftermath, to provide a university for all of Eastern Europe, to draw the best talent and to provide an intellectually free place. That has been a major target. Indeed, I'm told by people in Hungary that when you drive around, you only see two faces on billboards in the country. You see Viktor Orban, their populist leader, and then you see a really unattractive picture of George Soros as the person that they're demonizing. And this, by the way, is a tactic, this is a name which we're now starting to see in our politics being brought in as the supposed boogeyman financing the poor Honduran refugees. So the tactics spread from one country to another, and we're embedded in this global network of regressors, if I can use the term. So, well, what to do about all that? We're fortunate, in some sense, in the United States, that we have the First Amendment. It's absolutely critical. Freedom of association, freedom of speech. This is all we have. But it is one dimension on which the United States, I think, performs well in the, relative to other systems. In post-war Europe, there was a popular theory about how to write constitutions to protect democracy from itself, if I can use the term. That is, and it's called, the name of it is militant democracy. Democracies needed to guard against anti-democratic political parties. And so there were rules put in place that were used to ban the Communist Party in West Germany or ban the Nazi Party when it reformed. And just a few months ago were used to ban a pro-North Korean party in South Korea. The courts become the policemen about which parties can run and such. This, to me, is a very dangerous thing, and I don't think would work well in the United States, to give government those tools. The countries which have adopted those rules, much of Western Europe, have not really used them against the greatest, the anti-system parties which have succeeded in all those societies. So Marine Le Pen could run, but if you had a small Islamist party which with no chances of winning, they would not be allowed to. So to me, this is one area where the United States, we're fortunate to have what we have, which of course facilitates us all being here, which facilitates us to mobilize and be active. But I do fear about some aspects of our ecology in this regard. Universities are, to a great extent, dependent on government policy, and the sort of the government funding being politicized is, I think, somewhat of a risk in our time, and so something to watch for. And I think quite dangerous in an era of fake news and where there's this kind of attack on the very idea of facts. We do need institutions which work and, you know, fight about the facts, but at least have a mechanism for producing authoritative knowledge. So I think it is really important. Well, the bottom line is that we don't see a lot of... the United States seems to do... The Constitution does well on one dimension, surely, but not all of them. In many ways, it doesn't look very good. Now, some of you may know there is an effort underway to amend the Constitution using an aspect of Article 5 of the Constitution which most of us don't know much about, which is to have a new constitutional convention. And the list of people who have signed on to this is really quite diverse. It's Al Sharpton, it's Rand Paul, it's Fox News commentator Mark Levin. A lot of people want to have, it's the Koch brothers. A lot of people want to have a new constitutional convention in the United States. The idea is that we got problems, we should get together and fix them. I'm very wary of this. I think if we were to get together in the current state of American politics to try to write a new constitution, we'd end up at each other's throats. We might even have violence that emerged from it. And so that all we can do really is muddle along. That said, there are some things we can push for, short of constitutional amendment, that I think would be helpful. Number one, I think, is the electoral system and watching it and moving for nonpartisan administration of the elections. It's an obvious reform, and that has succeeded in several American states. I should say more broadly, that ties into an issue about defending a politics of democracy. It is true that we disagree about policies with the, you know, with our friends and colleagues and such, and we might have very fundamental disagreements. But it would be nice to reward candidates who were standing up in favor of democratic processes. I should say that at last week's election, I saw one very bright spot, which was the passage of Proposition 4 in Florida. I don't know how many of you saw that. This was the proposition which ended the disenfranchisement of felons for most crimes in Florida. 1 in 5 black men were not allowed to vote under this, and now they will be allowed to vote in the next election. And it was not even a close issue. In the state where, obviously, they're still counting the votes on the main candidates in the election, there was a 2/3 majority for that proposition. That suggests to me something very optimistic, that there might be a coalition out there to defend democratic processes, notwithstanding the media, notwithstanding all the, you know, the severe polarization that we feel. There may, in fact, be such a coalition. I think we need to mobilize around those issues and to ensure that those politics are rewarded. The other issue I think we really have to focus on, of course, is accountability generally. You know, since the Mueller investigation, which is on many people's minds, is special counsel in our current moment, is not really protected even by statute. It replaced the independent counsel, that was Ken Starr, who was protected by statute after the Starr investigation. They got rid of that statute. And so the Mueller investigation really is protected only by Department of Justice regulations, which could themselves be ended. That illustrates to me the structural weakness of accountability in the United States. And there's many other examples. Inspectors general who work in all the administrative agencies, really important for accountability, but they're not protected very well either. Scott Pruitt fired his, I believe, and they can reassign them. And this is something where we could have a statutory scheme to protect inspectors general, to help them do their jobs. That should be within reach. I would also like to see the return of what we call opposition rights, rights to the political opposition. This is what the filibuster was, if you think about it. It meant that to be a Supreme Court justice, you couldn't be a real extremist. You had to get a majority of the other side. And there was no problem, even through the appointment of Justice Roberts. Now that's over. So the partisan nature of the judicial appointments has really ended that. I'd like to see a return to those kind of things. One of the things I've been pushing is the idea that the subpoena power now the Democrats control the House, they should share that with the Republicans and allow the Republican minority to also exercise it. Now, that might not happen at all, but at least it would move back to the system which existed before 2015, where subpoena power was shared. So the basic point is that we need to recognize that the opposition has a role to play in democracy. In many constitutional systems, there's an official leader of the opposition. And if that's your setup, it's very hard to demonize the person. You know you're going to have to work with them. Some of these systems have opposition chairmanship of particular committees, like the auditing committees in Congress. All these things are quite feasible in the United States. They could be done by the rules of Congress if we had a kind of commitment to good governance. Well, let me just say a little more about, just before I finish, I would like to say a little bit about what we can all do. And of course, you know, you are all engaged in the fundamental value, the fundamental core activity of maintaining our democracy by speaking up, by organizing, by working together. I sometimes feel that our task now is as much spiritual as practical, in the sense that I am sometimes so down, so anxious, and so despondent that I don't know what to do. And trying to figure out ways to channel that energy into productive activity in defense of democracy is in some sense a collective thing. And we do need each other. We need organizations like this. We need you all to do what you do in terms of pushing for positions which will advance our democratic process and advance our democratic policies. So I think that's absolutely critical. Another thing I think we all can do, of course, is we're in a capitalist society, which means our consumption is a political act. And, you know, just knowing who the advertisers are on Breitbart News, for example, and making sure. Now, maybe very few of you would buy those products anyway, but that does, at some point, make a difference. Finally, I think, you know, making every effort to fight the polarization. We have to obviously fight for the powerful and important positions that we're trying to articulate. We hear a lot about civility, and, you know, sometimes that claim can go too far. But it's also important, and I think many of us have relatives on the other side, which kind of is a disciplining thing in terms of how much attacking you can do. For me, staying off of social media turns out to be fairly healthy because I sometimes just drives me crazy. But that, I think, is in some sense to keep the civil in the civil society and to try to engage with the other side. I think that's absolutely critical as well. Well, I'll close with one comment about the work that you're doing in Yemen, on Yemen. I think it's really, really important. It turns out that one of the ways in which our democracy has not worked as planned has to do with the war powers, right? That Congress is given the power to declare war. They've not done that since World War II. We fought over 200 conflicts, and yet only 4 declared wars. So this is an abdication, and it's a result of the partisan alignment. And of course, we do have the War Powers Act, which is trying to restore that balance, but it's one of constitutional contestation. Every president has said they do not think it's a constitutional statute. Every Congress has said it is constitutional, but they're often very reluctant to take the steps, the concrete self-enforcing steps that would make the War Powers Act a reality. To me, we're now in a position where that's actually feasible, because what is the concrete step that Congress could take to make the War Powers Act a reality? Deny the funding in the budget for certain actions. You can easily do that. And the politics might finally be there, where the Democratic House of Representatives would be in a position to say, yes, we support the troops, we're just not funding the Yemen thing. And so maybe we're going to see some good come out of the current configuration. I always remain optimistic. Thank you very much, and it's been a pleasure being here.
Yeah, we have a Q&A section right now if people want to ask our speaker. Actually, let's give another round of applause for Tom. Thank you. So, if you do want to, we'll just do a brief Q&A, and if folks have a comment or question, well, not comments, questions, just raise your hand, I'll come over.
So many attacks on the press and the media, some of them recent. Which bothers you the most?
Wow, that's a great question. To me, where the line was crossed was the physical attack. I'm not just talking about the bombs. The representative who physically, Gianforte, I think his name is in Montana, who physically attacked a representative and was applauded by the President of the United States. I cannot get my head around it. And I'm sorry. So I just said the physical attacks on the press seem to me to be quite clearly over the line.
Where any place, do you see any sympathetic strands in the Republican Party in support of democracy?
Yes, I do. Actually, believe it or not, later this week I'm going to go talk to the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. Yeah, right. On the libertarians, a committed libertarian. I mean, you have some people who I think what I call linos, libertarians in name only. But then there are some real libertarians who don't believe in foreign entanglements and wasting money overseas, who don't, you know, who are concerned about electoral processes and such, and are obviously a small political minority. And so I think, and are also concerned with criminal justice reform, right? That's an absolutely critical issue. The felon disenfranchisement, there's lots of room for alliances with people like that. The key to me, the big thing, is that so many of people in the Republican Party seem to have given up on any policy discussion whatsoever. It's not about policy. It's about personality for many of the voters. And that seems to me really hard to deal with. It's a kind of, because policy, we can debate, we can even disagree, but usually you think you can convince someone, or you're going to try. But when it's all about personality and there's no facts, no possibility of facts, then we're in big trouble.
You mentioned the gerrymandering issue that goes on, and it's If the Democratic blue states decided to play fair, play nice, get a group organization that does it correctly, how do you expect the red states, as we know them, to do the same?
Right. So, you know, why engage in unilateral disarmament, as you're suggesting? Well, I think there's some things we can do that might avoid that problem. The first thing is, without any statutory change or constitutional change, we could get all the secretaries of state together to talk about how we run elections and have some common standards, right? And I think this is really important in an era of potential foreign interference with the vote counting, that we have some common standards about the way elections are run, and so that we don't have the hanging chad problem, maybe some common standards on what counts as fraud, which is, of course, a non-existent problem, but to at least get some technocratic clarification on that. So I think that's one channel where we could see collective action. Another is the Electoral College. And there's been talk about Electoral College reform that runs precisely into the problem you identify. You know, if I'm California and I say, well, we're going to divide the votes up according to the percentage of voters in the state, and, you know, Wyoming doesn't, well, that's unilateral disarmament. And, of course, there's a major movement afoot to try to get a coalition of states that, so long as enough other states agreed to be in the coalition, would give all of the electoral votes to whoever got the national majority. And that, I think, is going to be a correction that we're going to need to adopt, because otherwise I think we're in for a long run of minority presidents, given the way the electoral map shakes out. And I don't really think that's sustainable for democracy. So I'd like to see that, and I don't think it's unilateral disarmament on that particular angle.
You're a lawyer and a professor of constitutional law. Lawyers are supposed to, in an ideal world, they're supposed to be a guild. We're custodians of the law and the principles of the law, just like doctors are a guild and accountants are a guild, just have professional standards and uphold these things. You talked about the fact that under the Constitution, the War Powers Resolution, Congress is supposed to have a monopoly on the decision to go to war if the United States has not been attacked. You talk to physicians who focus on heart disease and lung disease, there isn't the diversity of opinion about the effect of cigarettes, smoking cigarettes, maybe not. They're all in one corner. There's not like pro and con.
Yeah.
When will we see that among America's lawyers on the question of constitutional war powers?
Yeah.
Standing up and saying that, you know, if you don't believe that Congress has a monopoly on the decision to go to war, then you're not a lawyer. You're not part of the guild. You shouldn't be a professor of constitutional law. You're not willing to stand in the public square and say, under the Constitutional War Powers, this belongs to Congress, not the president. And we're, as you mentioned, we're at the cusp of a epic historical Waterloo. Where are the lawyers? Where are the professors of constitutional law?
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm not holding my breath on that one. Professional ethics, which you identify, are absolutely critical in this time. And they're actually good techniques, they're good tools, in essence, to hold particular individuals accountable. All of the people engaged in obstruction of justice, all the people around the president are terrified that they'll be disbarred and such. And so that's a powerful disciplining tool. But one of our ethics as lawyers, and I don't know if there's anyone else in the room who is one, is that of zealous advocacy. That's one of our requirements. We take our client, guilty or innocent, and we argue for them. And that's where lawyers are on this one. They're partisan, and they're divided. And so I think it'd be too much to expect lawyers as lawyers to unilaterally and uniformly oppose that. But I also think that those professional ethics need robust defense. And, you know, that may in the end be what saves us.
To what extent do you think rank order of voting would have any impact upon preserving democratic representation? Rank order voting?
Oh, yeah, sure. Right. So rank order voting is, generally speaking, students of voting systems think rank order voting is superior at eliciting people's preferences and such. And there's, you know, various other systems. One of my colleagues has a system which he calls the quadratic vote, where you'd get, I guess, 16 different, I guess you would pay for your vote, I think is the logic somehow, but it allows you to express, to have an intensity and not just ranked order among multiple choices. All of those things are really good, and we do have democracy that experiment with them at some small level. At the end of the day, I don't know. I mean, I think that our divisions in the United States are very, very real, and maybe that no voting system would, you know, resolve them other than having getting rid of the Electoral College and having actually, you know, the majority decide.
Earlier you talked about populism as being a negative thing. You know, populism is simply a reaction to the failures of the constitutional order to actually make decent lives for people. Do you think that there is a form of populism that you would support, or do you really feel that it's a negative thing?
No, I do. Look, I think populism is absolutely essential to the system, in the sense that it's about accountability. When an elite is out of touch, populism is what is supposed to bring them back into touch. You only get populist movements when the elite has been out of touch. So it plays a very important role in this system. But I like to distinguish between running as a populist and governing as a populist. When people govern as populists, tends not to end very well. You know, and the record, even in the United States, of Huey Long and such, it's the charismatic populist who I fear, because they are often demagogues, and that can be problematic. And I recognize Huey Long delivered a kind of machine in Louisiana that made the lives of his constituents better, so there's a good side. But there also seems to be this, you know, monomaniacal quality to the charismatic populist, which I think in our era is a threat.
I have a question. In talking about democracy, when I actually go to the voting booth myself personally, I don't feel that this is a democracy, because neither of the parties actually represent my own beliefs. Hmm. You know, you have the most enthusiastic pro-capitalist party in human history at one end, and then you have the second most extreme pro-capitalist party, you know, next to them. And, you know, I'm just wondering about, is democracy really possible in this kind of two-party system, where the system acts to completely in a gatekeeping role, whereas in Europe, you know, you do have parties that on the left that would create pressure, you know, on the centrist party to govern in a more popular way, whereas, you know, on the right there's no need for pressure because it's already completely extreme. So
yeah. That's a great question. I didn't say much about my definition of democracy. In the book, we take a very narrow definition, or a very thin definition, I guess you could say. You have to have elections where the loser gives up power if they were in power. You have to have basic rights to freedom of association and speech. And you have to have the bureaucratic rule of law. But in that definition, we don't get into, you know, particular policies. Now, that said, I do think in the United States we would do better, for me, if we were a parliamentary system. I'd like to see that, because it allows us to throw people out of office once they're no longer popular, and allow us to keep people in office when they're doing a good job. I also think I'd like to see some kind of proportional representation. You know, I think to me the core issue in our country is the continued effects of slavery, and the inability of our country to not only grapple with it, but to not represent the interests of African Americans, who would certainly do better as a dispersed minority if there was a proportional representation system. And I think that would, you know, lead to better quality governance. But that's my view, and it's obviously not shared by everyone.
Are you willing to venture any guesses as to what's likely to happen in the next few weeks or months? Is Mueller actually going to indict Trump? Fire, are we going to have an actual constitutional crisis? What do you think is likely to happen in the next few months?
Yeah, that's a great question, of course. The future isn't here, but so I don't know. I think I'm not sure he's going to fire Mueller. I'm not sure Mueller has that much. We don't really know, but certainly we might see some low-level indictments, some more after the election. The key thing, I think, is going to be, for a potential constitutional crisis, to me, the way it would play out is House demands tax returns, executive, president makes up some executive privilege excuse to not deliver them, and the Supreme Court just, you know, stays out of the fray. I could see that scenario, even though there are cases, of course, the Watergate case with Nixon, where he was forced to turn over the tapes by the Supreme Court on a claim of executive privilege. I'm not sure this court would follow that precedent, and I'm not sure they'd say that tax returns were enough. And so I could see a kind of constitutional crisis coming down. Beyond that, I could imagine we're going to get into some, we might have a government stoppage in the next couple of years. I don't know if that's a constitutional crisis, but I could see fighting over the wall funding or something like that leading to a government standstill. So I don't think it's going to be a very pretty couple of years, which is why it's really important to stay engaged and to continue to reward the folks who are doing the good work.
I know I'm supposed to pass the mic around, but I actually have a question. So you talked about the courts. I feel like we've been in constitutional crisis since Merrick Garland didn't really get even a hearing. And I just wanted you to talk about that and just the illegitimacy of the Supreme Court right now.
Right. So I'm on the record as saying two things. First of all, there's talk about packing the courts and, you know, a lot of debate over the last couple of months. If the Democrats ever take all the both the Senate and presidency again, shouldn't they pack the courts? I think we've already been in an era of court packing. I think that's what we've been experiencing, and that moment when Garland wasn't even given a hearing really marked it quite clearly. I'm also on the record as saying that Kavanaugh's comment in the hearing, where he denounced the Clintons, I thought was unprecedented, and to me means he has to recuse himself from any case involving a Democratic Party election official or any issue like that. So I think the court's in a very severe legitimacy crisis, and I think Roberts knows this, and so his response is probably going to be very minimalist on the big public issues while continuing to advance his agenda on the lower profile things. Courts are obviously a critical arena. I think we're in for a rough ride. I think what ought to happen, if we were ever to have a situation where the Democrats got a majority of both sides, is not to pack the courts the other way so much as to go back to the status quo ante, and this isn't unilateral disarmament, not just to adopt the filibuster, but actually expand the federal courts with a bipartisan slate of people who could get 60 votes on both sides, get some centrist judges, expand the courts, and we need to expand the courts. The judges will tell you there aren't enough federal judges to handle the business. It is the case in the United States that constitutional remedies are not very good. If the police were to come in here and arrest us all for nothing, yeah, we might get out in a while. They might pay a damages award some years down the road after lots of litigation, and we can all fund that, you know. If you're an ordinary person, there's not very good constitutional remedies. So expanding the power of the courts would actually be good as long as it's a depoliticized kind of set of judges that are upholding the law and upholding the Constitution.
On your definition of three essential elements necessary for popular form of government, the word democracy is a little bit scary and sticky. But in addition to that, what would your position be on the subject of the press, which is guaranteed by the original Constitution, to count the First Ten Amendments, commonly referred to as the Bill of Rights, as freedom of the press, but the diversity of sources, to me, is so essential. And in addition to that, a press that is independent of government, not just the government's stenographer.
Right. So as a general structural matter, I think something that's really important, which we don't talk much about, is antitrust law and the press. know, there's been a tremendous consolidation of the radio around the country and the media in other ways. It's a little bit tricky because giving the power of government to police the press using antitrust, you know, tools has turned out to be very effective for people in places, for Erdogan in Turkey, for example, or Orban in Hungary. So it's a little bit of a two-edged sword, but I do think that is important, and obviously we do need to celebrate. And in a way, that's us as consumers. We have to spread the idea that you really should read a bunch of different sources and figure it out for yourself. I'd also like to see attention to something I haven't really read much about, but something about digital citizenship, how to get, you know, students and such to understand, you know, wow, just because it's on the internet doesn't mean it's true. How do you sort out what's true and false in an era of fake news? That's a big problem. I haven't seen much work on that. So that's something for us to start to do some work on.
From what I understand, sanctions, unilateral sanctions against whoever are illegal under international law. And we seem to be doing a lot of them in every direction around the world. Would you comment on that? And I'd like to repeat David's invitation that he mentioned earlier, that there is going to be a program tomorrow given by a professor of economic history who has lived in Venezuela for many years. He's speaking at the University of Chicago tomorrow morning, afternoon, and he'll be in Evanston at 6:30 tomorrow. And he's going to be speaking about Venezuela and sanctions.
Great.
So it might be a good opportunity to hear some news.
Yes. So, you know, as an international lawyer, I'm not sure I'd agree with that statement. That's there's kind of this conventional wisdom that until World War II, or I guess until the Kellogg-Briand Treaty, that there was no possibility of economic sanctions. The only tool available in international law if you wanted to coerce a country was war. And then with Kellogg-Briand, we moved to an era of sanctions, and they don't necessarily need to be multilateral. You can, you know, a state is free to trade with, take investment from whoever they want. That's basic sovereignty. Now, it is also the case that the Trump administration is very active in its use of sanctions, despite its kind of, you know, isolationist, you know, rhetoric and such. And they don't seem to have much effect. If there's anything that the literature suggests, is that economic sanctions, even multilateral ones, rarely are able to coerce a state to change a fundamental policy. And, of course, the collateral damage can be very severe, as we saw in Iraq in the 1990s. You know, the excess deaths, something like 700,000 people from the multilateral sanctions there. So I'm not sure they're illegal, but they're often ineffective.
You mentioned the legitimacy of the court. How about the legitimacy of two past Republican governments due to at least one, the interference of the court? The other, the stealing of the election in states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, and the way the press, the mainstream press, played its part in normalizing the effects of that or the outcome of that, leading to a discrediting of itself, which now has manifested to the sort of gross image of it's an enemy of the people, which I don't agree with, but certainly there is a bias to the corporate press, as there is a bias to all corporate activities in pursuing its interests against the interests of the people, the nation state, etc. Could you comment on that?
Well, yeah. I guess I'd say one thing is that, you know, we're all focused on, you know, the daily news and the sort of shocking stuff that happens, the attacks on norms and institutions. The decline in American institutions is decades long. You know, the numbers suggest a very sharp decline beginning around the Iraq War. You know, in faith in institutions like Congress, the courts, the executive, the press, everything, in some sense, we've seen declining legitimacy, declining approval ratings. At this point in American history, the press, the president, the Congress, and the courts all have approval ratings under 50%. It's hard for me to imagine how you sustain a democracy when all the branches of government are not supported by the people. So it's a very deep and fundamental process that's been going on. And it's one that, you know, yeah, the current administration is quite an accelerant of, but not the sole cause. Symptom more than cause is my view. And so maybe that's in alignment with what you said. I mean, the press, obviously there's bias. Any press is going to have bias, any opinion. So the question then is there enough of a structure so that you have a competition of ideas? And that seems to be actually pretty active right now, maybe too much competition in ideas.
Okay, we have time for two more questions.
I'd love to hear more about your ideas of proportional representation for African Americans. Mm. But I'd also like to talk about another aspect of American government that could be argued as fundamentally undemocratic, and that's the Senate. And that I think many of us feel that because there is this oversized influence of states with very small populations, how possible is it to have a truly democratic system of representation?
Yeah. Well, so that is obviously totally hardwired into the Constitution. It's the one provision which can't even be amended by the normal amendment procedure. No state can be denied its equal representation in the Senate without its own approval. So basically that's never going to change. So all you can do, really, I think, is to, if you're the Democrats, you have to compete in 50 states. That's the first thing, right? You can't just say leave swaths of the country without competition. And that was the original design. They wanted it to slow things down. They wanted, the saucer of the hot tea of policy. So it's just built in, unless we were to change the Constitution entirely. On the proportional representation idea, some countries have special electorates. So you'd go and you'd vote twice, depending what group you're part of and such. And we could imagine something like that. I don't think it's likely to sell in the United States, but maybe part of a general proportional representation system, you might have a party that was like explicitly, representing the interests of African Americans. Like the Congressional Black Caucus, does have good number of seats, and they can be important on certain policies, but they're not at the swing vote, which they might be if we were in a true PR system.
Okay, last question.
I think we've all been listening intently, somewhat worried. Throughout your talk, you've made comments about concerns about if our democracy will survive, that kind of thing. And they've mentioned legitimacy of the court and legitimacy of elections as well. So the question really is, have we gotten to the point where we should be concerned about our democracy? How will we know? And is there some model out there that would give us an idea as to we're coming closer to the end? Are we just coming to a natural fizzle, if you will?
Natural what was the last word?
Fizzle.
Yeah. Well, I think that's exactly the point. It's a slow and steady decline. And again, it's not just me. This is Americans in polls after polls say the same thing, that our elections are not run well, that the quality of our representation is poor, the quality of our democracy, the approval of many institutions. Participation is low, most Americans think. Most Americans think our system is corrupt, that their office holders get personal and pecuniary benefits. So there's a real number of dimensions on which this is happening. And precisely because it's one step at a time, this is what we learn from the countries like Venezuela or Hungary or Poland. Precisely because it's one step at a time, you can't pick the moment when it ends, when democracy dies. How would you know that that's the moment? And that's why, actually, if there's one thing I could, if we could somehow magically all agree that this step is going to bring everyone out into the streets and we've had enough, this one action, could become the focal point for some kind of mobilization. It's just really, really hard to do in a country of 300 million people that's very polarized. So in that sense, I'm 100% sure democracy in some form in the United States will continue. We will have elections. We will have, some freedom of organization and such. But I'm also pretty certain that it's heading in the wrong direction in terms of degradation of the fundamental institutions which are necessary to make democracy work. And that's something that I think it's hard to get mobilized around, institutions. I mean, the questions you've been asking about the press and the courts is really important, in that regard. But it's hard to get people out in the street for an inspector general or something like that. And that's in the end where the rubber meets the road to protect our democracy. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you so much.
So I just want to thank Professor Ginsberg for sharing his time with us tonight. There are books for sale in the lobby. A couple other little notes I want to remind you of. There will be, you know, that Shireen is going to be speaking at Loyola on Saturday, December 1st. On Friday, November 30th, we will be convening in Federal Plaza at 11 a.m. Rally should last around 11 to 1, and then we'll send a delegation up to Tammy Duckworth's office to beseech her to sign on to SJ 54. I want to remind you also that Senator Dick Durbin is an original co-sponsor of that legislation. There is absolutely no reason for the junior senator from Illinois to not be signed on as a co-sponsor.